We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
For our listeners, you might hear a little bit of an echo. We've got Job roped in on this in a special way because he's having some internet issues.
We had some technical issues this morning, so this is kind of jury-rigged. Hope it works.
All right, so starting out with announcement from Mayor Durkin and Councilmember Lisa Herbold.
Yeah, there were a couple of proposed bills that one of which Mayor Durkin and City Council Public Safety Committee Chair Lisa Herbold announced this week, a new bill that Herbold is going to be taking up in her committee this coming week. It would strengthen the ability of the Office of Police Accountability and the Office of the Inspector General of the Seattle Police Department to issue subpoenas to witnesses in police use of force cases, which are under review by those two bodies. The two groups already have the authority to compel police to testify, but this new subpoena power would apply to civilians who are involved in or witness police use of force and who've refused to testify, including the family members of police. Initially, the 2017 Police Accountability Ordinance passed by the City of Seattle granted this authority to the OPA and the OIG, subject to the City Council passing a separate ordinance and the Seattle Police Unions bargaining this into their contracts. Neither of those two things have actually happened yet. And the current Seattle Police Officers Guild contract negotiated with the mayor's office in 2018, explicitly rolled back that subpoena power, and specifically as it applies to SPD officers, their family members, and any personal belongings or records kept by SPD officers outside of the workplace. Now, Durkin and Herbold are trying to pass the promised ordinance by the council. Notably, this ordinance still says that the subpoena power of the OPA and the OIG is going to be subject to bargaining with the police unions. Now, a couple of weeks ago, Durkin and Herbold had announced that all three police accountability bodies, the OPA, the OIG, and the Community Police Commission, will have representatives at the table next year when the city bargains the new Seattle Police Officers Guild contract. In addition, a member of the City Council's central staff will also be in the room to witness the progress of the talks and then report back to the City Council. And those are historic firsts for the City of Seattle. This could make it much harder for SPOG to undermine the 2017 Police Accountability Ordinance in their new contract. Certainly, this bill granting the OPA and the OIG subpoena powers is a step in the right direction, although it's a small step and it's a first step, and there's still a lot of hurdles that they have to get over in order to actually have this be part of the OPA's and the OIG's powers, including getting the police unions to sign off on it and getting Judge James Robart, who has been overseeing the police accountability process in court, to also sign off on it. Now, Herbold's Public Safety Committee is going to take up the bill this coming Tuesday, December 8th. And then we'll see if any other members of the council try to water down the bill, or if the bill actually goes to the full council sooner rather than later. There was another bill announced this week. Back in 2019, Mike O'Brien, who was a city council member at that time, introduced a bill to ban the use of gas heat in new construction in Seattle. It was his effort kind of right before he left office to address the city's greenhouse gas emissions and to kind of start the process of implementing the Green New Deal city had passed. After an outcry by the local utility, Puget Sound Energy, and companies that make gas heating systems, that bill was actually scrapped and didn't make it out of his committee. This week, Mayor Durkin announced a new stripped-down version of that bill. Her bill would focus on limiting natural gas heat in new commercial buildings and large apartment buildings, otherwise known as multifamily housing, and it would ban gas water heating in hotels and large apartment buildings. Instead, developers would be required to use energy-efficient electrical systems. And in buildings where developers opt to install gas stoves or other gas appliances, they would also be required to install alternative electrical hookups so that electrical stoves and appliances could be used later. Single-family homes and townhouses, however, would not be covered by this bill because the state issues energy codes for single-family housing and townhomes instead of the city. Although I don't think there's anything that would prevent the city necessarily from issuing their own laws that govern those inside the city of Seattle. But I think that's something that the Democrats in the state legislature should be pushed to introduce this upcoming session. Now, there would also be no changes for existing structures under this bill. Labor groups, of course, are behind the bill, but many environmental groups say that it won't be enough to significantly cut greenhouse gas emissions from the building sector in Seattle. Nothing really is going to make a big enough dent until the city begins helping current homeowners and landlords to replace the existing gas systems in their existing buildings. And this is one of many things, I think, that the Jumpstart payroll tax is earmarked for doing, is to provide funds for homeowners to replace existing gas lines with electrical systems once the COVID-19 pandemic passes, because the Jumpstart payroll tax bill is going to be used for COVID-19 relief in the first year or so. Now, about one quarter of the city's greenhouse gas emissions are from the use of natural gas and oil in the city's buildings and homes. The largest portion, or just over 60% of Seattle's greenhouse gas emissions, comes from the transportation sector. Now, Durkin said that she will introduce this bill to the city council later this month, and it could be as soon as this coming week. And we will see whether it progresses through the city council before the end of the year.
Moving on, Sound Transit.
Yeah, speaking of greenhouse gas emissions in the transportation sector, there was some good news this week. Sound Transit announced that the electricity that powers the Link light rail system is now 100% carbon free and renewable energy. Sound Transit has signed a contract with Puget Sound Energy to use electricity from their Green Direct program, which delivers power directly to clients who sign up for the program that's generated from wind power at the Skookumchuck Wind Facility, which is Western Washington's largest wind power project. Of course, Sound Transit also manages a heavy rail and bus system and large construction expansion projects, as well as maintenance bases, which still have a ways to go to be carbon free. But Sound Transit has joined the Climate Registry and is making a serious effort to move to 100% carbon free in all of its electrical operations by 2030, which is just 10 years away, and all of its other energy use to be carbon free by 2050. Now, that includes adding a solar power generator this coming year to its east maintenance facility. So it's making some strides there. And if you're asking yourself which is more energy efficient, taking my car or taking the light rail, taking the light rail is going to be the winner in just about 99% of the cases. Now, a recent status update by Sound Transit reported that the new Northgate Link section is 97% completed and is expected to open by this coming September. And all that remains is testing and safety certification. And I'd have to say that's very good news for those of us who've been waiting for light rail service to North Seattle for what seems like more than a decade. Now, EastLink, the line that will run to Mercer Island, Bellevue, and eventually to Redmond, Sound Transit says that's about 85% complete. In addition, Sound Transit is continuing construction on lines from Northgate to Linwood, from SeaTac Airport south to Federal Way, and an expansion of the Tacoma Link Rail to the hilltop area of Tacoma, probably the heaviest transit neighborhood, the neighborhood that is in most need of really reliable transit in the city of Tacoma. And planning continues on a separate Link light rail line from Ballard to West Seattle, including a second tunnel downtown. And all of that's going to need money. Now, as Link Light Rail expands, the city could make major inroads in cutting greenhouse gas emissions from transportation if Link continues on its current path to be 100% carbon free in all of its operations. Notably, Metro Transit's old, in looking at our other major transportation transit system, Metro Transit's old strategic plan was developed in 2015 and it originally covered the years 2011 to 2021. That old plan was recently replaced by a new plan called Metro Connects, which emphasizes their push for a new fleet of buses that is more energy efficient. And that would include hybrid electric vehicles, battery buses, electric trolley buses, and green diesel, although I'm pretty unclear on what green diesel actually means. But that would require funding for the purchase of over 600 new buses, which Metro currently doesn't have in their budget. So there's obviously a need for a mix of new tax revenue and funding from state and federal sources, not just to make Metro green, but to expand bus service to the county's expanding population. And I'm sure Metro is also running deficits because of the COVID-19 pandemic shutdown. So Metro's got a ways to go before it can meet that same goal that Link Light Rail has just met. So there's an update on our local transit options. And yes, if you are evaluating what's greener, drive in my car, or taking the bus or the light rail, generally it's the transit option unless you're driving an electric vehicle and you're part of the city's Green Direct program where you're purchasing energy from a renewable source.
Yeah, and if you're taking the transit option, those buses and those trains are going to run anyway. That's a sunk cost in terms of energy. Whereas if you park your car, then it's not running and it's not emitting gases.
Yeah.
Okay. Moving on, City of Seattle, there was some positions that Mayor Durkan shifted this week.
Yes, Jason Johnson is gone. That's the big news. Mayor Durkan's original pick to run the city's human services department, Jason Johnson, is finally leaving his office. When Durkan first proposed Johnson, it was back in 2018, the city council didn't bring up his nomination for a vote, and she blamed Shama Sawant, who chaired the committee that would have introduced his nomination, for holding up the vote, although notably no other council member took up the nomination either, although they could have. Johnson's appointment raised an outcry among employees in the Human Services Department and groups that contract with HSD, who said that Durkan had promised she would do a national search for a new Human Services Director, and instead she picked Johnson, who was the former Deputy Director. Faced with this opposition,
and it was also wildly unpopular among service providers.
Yeah, faced with this opposition, Durkan withdrew his nomination and announced instead that she would keep him on permanently as an acting head, you know, much like Donald Trump has been doing with his cronies. Johnson has served as interim director ever since, even after he said initially that he'd leave by early 2020. Now his leave date is firm and it's set at January 15th, 2021, but he may take early vacation and be gone as soon as this coming Monday. Durkan has appointed Helen Howell as the new interim director. She's currently a senior policy director for the King County Housing Authority, and she's had years of experience working on homelessness issues. Howell will serve while Durkan finally starts a nationwide search almost 3 years after she originally made that promise. Now, Howell will be in charge of setting up the new HOPE team, the new HOPE program, to oversee the city's contracts with outside service organizations who will be providing outreach to the homeless population in place of the old city-run navigation team, which largely swept homeless encampments without providing real services or real connection to housing to the homeless. Howell will also be part of the city council's efforts to direct more funding to BIPOC community groups and to help identify who should get that funding through the participatory budgeting process. And in addition, Howell will continue to work on setting up the new regional agency on homelessness and figuring out which city services and employees will be transferred to the new agency. Much of that work has been delayed because of the COVID-19 pandemic shutdown. So we'll see how Howell does in her position as interim director of the Human Services Department, and we'll see how the nationwide search goes, especially during the pandemic lockdown, if Durkin makes much progress. My guess is
an election year also.
Oh, yeah. And my guess is Howell's going to be in this position for a while. The good news is that she appears to be a big improvement over Jason Johnson in terms of experience with these issues and understanding of the root causes of homelessness and what it takes to get people stabilized and into permanent housing.
That's a very low bar, but I would say also that Johnson is a pretty good reflection of Durkin's priorities, that she was really driving the bus on a lot of those issues because it was one of the most high-profile issues in the city up until the pandemic.
It hasn't gone away.
It's still an issue, but I think Jason Johnson pretty accurately reflected, his boss's approach to homelessness policies. And it's been a disaster.
Yeah. Johnson was also big on the collecting lots of data points, assembling them and showing that the city's making progress, because look, numbers, without really looking at what are the root causes of homelessness, where are the shortfalls in the city's response, et cetera.
He was a master at lying with statistics.
Yeah.
If you give somebody a voucher for a couple of months, they're considered permanently housed.
Yeah, I wouldn't say lying. I would say more obscuring with statistics what the actual what was actually going on the street. So I think that's very good news that Johnson is out and Howell is in, at least as interim director.
Yeah, and we'll see if how she approaches this and how whether her professional background or Durkin's political instincts hold sway in HSD.
Hmm. Okay. Anything else on that?
Nope.
No, we may have run through our unusual spate of good news for the show.
For the year, maybe.
Yeah. Well, let's hope not.
Yeah, we probably should have spread those out for, saved one for next week. All right. Moving on, let's talk about developments this week with COVID.
Yeah, well, so much for the good news, because Washington State is looking pretty bad. There's about 170,000 confirmed cases now. The big news this past week has been Washington State launching a new app that can anonymously help you using your smartphone find out if somebody has tested positive that you've been in proximity to. Now, this is a very rough tool. It's not refined. It doesn't show you, for instance, how long you were exposed to that person. It just tells you to go get a test. It's called WA Notify, and about 20% of cell phone users in Washington State signed up in this first week since it was launched on Monday.
I was too.
So it is anonymous. It's a very good idea, and it's been used in European countries and in some other states. Over 1 million people now have already signed up, so I would encourage listeners to do this also. It does flag if you've been near somebody that turned out to test positive. You should go get a test also.
If you've gotten sick, you must use the app to notify so that other people can know whether they've been exposed to you. So that's the other side of it that will help to make the app actually work for everyone is if you also notify if you have tested positive.
Right. And, you know, if you're waiting for a test and you've been notified, you should probably self-quarantine also until you get cleared. But it is, in terms of contact tracing, it's a very helpful app. So I would encourage people to go into that. The other thing Washington State did this week is it signed off on the CDC's prioritization of vaccine distribution. What this means is that healthcare workers are going to get the first priority for vaccine distribution, then followed by people who live in or work in long-term care facilities, then followed by people who are vulnerable to the virus, that is people who have underlying health conditions or immunocompromised over the age of 65, et cetera, and then the general public. So we're probably looking at early spring before the general public can access the vaccine. This is something all the different states are going through because there is no coordinated federal response because, of course, we have a federal government that doesn't believe there's a pandemic, apparently. And this brings us to the national news, which is utterly dreadful in terms of the pandemic. All 50 states are seeing rising cases. The U.S. now is over 14 million confirmed cases and 275,000 deaths. We have the state of California. Almost all of the populated areas have gone into lockdown this weekend. California this week became the first state to record 100,000 new cases in 1 week. It's quite bad. They're about to overtake Texas for the most number of cases in the country. One other thing locally is that we were talking about light rail a little earlier. The light rail schedule starting Monday is going to become less frequent because they've run out of drivers. There are so many drivers who are out, either out sick or quarantining, or it's not coming into work because, you know, they have to take care of their kids who are not in school or whatever it is. They are really short on drivers for the trains. And they've got some more coming in who are now in training who will be available in the middle of January. So you're probably going to see a reduced light rail schedule until then. So we're seeing that, and we're seeing staffing shortages at a number of area hospitals and medical clinics, because, you know, they're getting to be overwhelmed. And Washington State, this is one of the reasons California is already in lockdown. California, Oregon, and Washington are the three states in the country with the lowest per capita, ICU bed availability. For whatever reason, Washington State, is second only to Oregon in its limited ICU capacity, and that is starting to fill up. So that is a very serious concern. You're seeing also, you're starting to see in a lot of different parts of the country, burnout and people, healthcare workers just quitting their jobs because they've been working insane hours for months and months and months, and it's just getting worse and worse. It really shows a lot of the limitations of the American healthcare system, and we're starting to run into those limitations. You know, the caseload and the hospitalization rate in the United States writ large has doubled in the last month, and we're just starting to see the additional cases coming in because of all the Thanksgiving travel, and then hard on that, we're going to see the holiday travel around Christmas and New Year's as well. So it's looking grim. The incoming Biden administration named its healthcare team this week and this past 2 weeks actually, and they're trying their best to get ramped up for this, but they're not getting a lot of cooperation from the outgoing Trump administration. We're supposedly in the phase now where the transition is formally cooperating, a lot of the political appointees under Trump are not cooperating with Biden's team. And this is becoming a problem for vaccine distribution, for public health measures, et cetera, et cetera. We're gonna have a real serious problem here for the next several months, I think.
Can I talk for a second about the shortage of hospital beds?
Sure, go for it.
one of the reasons why a lot of hospitals have a shortage of hospital beds, particularly the more expensive to run ICU beds, is because we have a privatized healthcare system, essentially.
Absolutely. Yes.
You know, when the hospital is a company that has to generate double digit profits for their shareholders, that means they cut back on the more expensive services. And, that's meant a decrease in actual ICU hospital beds, and a downturn in the number that are available over the last few decades. You know,
yeah. And we've seen also a lot of rural hospitals closing in this country because
yeah.
of that same.
Yeah, and so we're starting to see the effects of that right now in a pandemic, that when those beds are needed nationwide, and we need a lot of them, they're not there because it wasn't profitable to have vacant hospital beds for companies in private companies that needed to, you know, post double-digit returns and pay their shareholders. Now, in public healthcare systems, that hasn't happened. That hasn't happened to the extent that it's happened here. Of course, that doesn't mean that if we had a public healthcare system, we wouldn't still be overwhelmed, particularly with the denial of the pandemic that's going on and the fact that people are running around without masks and are traveling for the holidays and getting together with people they haven't seen for months. We probably would still be seeing our healthcare system overwhelmed to some degree, but it wouldn't be to the degree that we're seeing right now, I think.
Yeah. The other the relatively good news early this week was the resignation of Dr. Scott Atlas. He was the cardiologist who was put in charge of the White House coronavirus task force, and a Hoover Institute fellow who believes in herd immunity. He had been running the White House coronavirus task force, such as it was, for the last 3 months. And in that time, the official federal policy of the United States pretty much was literally to let everybody get infected. And we're seeing the fruits of that now. Between him and Donald Trump, who seems to have checked out entirely from the pandemic, he has made no particular mention of it, although he is calling a summit for next Tuesday, which a lot of the key people in vaccine production and distribution were not invited to, actually, even though that's supposedly the topic of the White House summit next Tuesday. White House aides quoted anonymously are saying basically that it's going to be his continuing attempt to take credit for vaccine development, and that's really all that is. It really shows what his priorities have and have not been. In terms of leadership during what has been the worst public health crisis, arguably in U.S. history and world history, certainly since the Spanish flu, and maybe worse than that by the time we're done. But Atlas is out, which is good. It would be nice if he and Trump could face some sort of future accountability for the hundreds of thousands of unnecessary deaths that their negligence has caused over the last several months. But I doubt that's going to happen. We saw a number, now that Trump is no longer paying attention to the pandemic, the CDC and the FDA and the Coronavirus Task Force and all sorts of people seem to have found their voice. We saw some very dire warnings this week, both from Robert Redfield, who is the head of the CDC, and also the White House Coronavirus Task Force, saying that it's going to get really bad. You know, we're looking at maybe 450,000 dead by February in the United States. Between the travel of Thanksgiving and Christmas and the still widespread noncompliance with wearing masks in public in some parts of the country. And we saw, again, some more prominent Republicans testing positive this week. The science of trying to prevent the spread of a pandemic, which we know what works. We saw things work last spring when we were willing to shut down the economy for 2 weeks at a time. That seems like a relatively small price at this point, doesn't it? But and the kind of shutdowns that are being done in California now and the the restrictions that are in place in Washington State are much more targeted now because we know a lot more about how the virus spreads, that it is primarily spread by airborne transmission and not by surfaces, for example. It's still possible to spread it by surfaces, but it's primarily spread through the air. You know, wearing a mask helps. It protects you. It protects others. The CDC recommending this week that, you know, if you're immunocompromised and you walk into an indoor space and see somebody without a mask, walk out again. And that wearing a mask protects you as well as protecting other people. So
yeah, I just want to emphasize there. Sorry. I just want to emphasize there that that should be true for anyone, immunocompromised or not. If you walk into an indoor space and you see anyone without a mask on, you should turn around and walk back out. Normal, healthy people who are relatively young who have gotten COVID-19 have also died from it and or experienced side effects, ongoing things like fatigue, muscle aches, and problems with their internal organs from continuing heart problems to problems with their neurological system for months after their infections. So,
yeah, and some of those impacts may be permanent. We don't know yet.
Yeah.
But they've lingered for months and months and months, and in some cases continue to linger. And we don't know what differentiates people who respond so harshly from people who get relatively mild symptoms or no symptoms at all. We're still learning about this virus, but it is a nasty piece of work. So, you know, the best thing to do is to do everything you can to not get it. And we've got a lot more information now on how that spread can be stopped, both in terms of individual behavior, and in terms of public policy. So we have the tools. We just haven't had any coordinated federal response. And we've had, you know, a good chunk of the country that's been taking their cues from the White House that, you know, and the idea that you don't have to take public health measures and it's an abridgment of freedom and blah, blah, blah. No, it's not. It's keeping everybody alive. And that has to be the priority right now.
Okay. Moving on.
Yes.
Yeah, so much for all the good news, right?
Yeah, but we should all be used to that by now.
Yeah, so let's talk about U.S. District Judge restoring the DACA program.
Okay. Yes. Judge Nicholas Garofas, I believe is how it's pronounced, of the U.S. District Court in Brooklyn late last night, directed the Trump administration to allow newly eligible immigrants to file new applications for protection under DACA by Monday. That reverses a memorandum that was issued last summer by Chad Wolf, the acting Secretary of Homeland Security, which restricted the program to people who were already enrolled. That means as many as 300,000 new applicants can now be eligible. Now, various immigration advocacy groups have been trying to challenge the Trump administration's basic killing of the DACA program for months and months, but this was an unexpected ruling. This was not something that was that people were expecting the federal judge to do, and it really underscores how lawlessly the Trump administration has been acting on immigration policy, and particularly Stephen Miller, the senior advisor in the White House, who has primarily been the architect of Trump's immigration policies. The other thing that we found out this week in a related lawsuit was that various advocacy groups have been trying to pressure the administration to comply with previous court orders in order to hand over information that would help reunify children separated at the border from their parents. Now, a lot of those kids, the administration has been saying, well, we didn't keep any of that information. And so you've literally had advocacy groups going from door to door in Central American countries trying to locate families whose children were kidnapped by the U.S. government. And we know that there are upwards of 1,000 of those kids. Well, it turns out in a court filing, again yesterday, that the Trump administration has had phone numbers and addresses for the families all along, even though they have told various judges and courts that they did not have any more information. This is unspeakable. So this is kids who were separated at the border, maybe put into foster care in some other part of the country, two or three years ago. They may not even remember their parents, depending on how old they were when they were kidnapped. And the government has been sitting on the information that could reunify them with their families all along.
It just makes me wonder about, the Trump administration personnel who are trying to delete and destroy information on as they're on the way out the door. If maybe some superior in Homeland Security gave the order to destroy this information and some underling said, that's just one step too far, I'm releasing it, It just kind of makes me wonder how and why it's being released right now. And I'm guessing that it may have to do with some decision that Trump, a political appointee, made to just start destroying all this information. And maybe some underling said, hey, no, I can't sleep at night if that happens. I'm just going to release this.
I'm even more cynical about it. We also saw the reporting this week that Trump has a short list of 20 people that he's considering for preemptive pardons, which is to say pardoning for anything that you may have done in part with the administration, even if you haven't been charged criminally for it yet, but you could be down the road. My cynicism is that there are a lot more than 20 people who have been engaged in gross criminality in the Trump administration. And so the people who are farther down that list who may not have Trump's attention because they haven't been sufficiently loyal or whatever the lunatic test is, are starting to cover their butts now. It's just unspeakable. And there needs to be criminal prosecutions for a lot of this kind of stuff. But, that kind of damage to those kids, in many cases, is going to be lifelong trauma. It blows my mind.
Okay. Let's move on and talk about the $908 billion bipartisan stimulus bill that's being considered by Congress. It's being termed a bipartisan bill. The Democrats have certainly been pushing for trillions of dollars in aid. The Republicans pushing for a much, much smaller bill. I just wanted to talk for a minute about what's in this quote-unquote bipartisan bill and
We should note that both Pelosi and Schumer have signed off on this bill.
Yeah.
The question again is getting Republicans to agree to it.
Yeah. So I'm just going to list what is in it and then what isn't in it. The biggest item in the bill is $288 billion for businesses, mostly through the Paycheck Protection Program. This is meant to be money for small businesses, right? But a recent analysis of the businesses that received money through the first round of funding in the Paycheck Protection Program shows that 1% of the businesses received up to a quarter of all of the funding in the program. That's about 600 large corporations received the maximum loan amount of $10 million from the U.S. government. And a lot of those big corporations are very, very large restaurant chains like the Outback Steakhouse chain or Ted Turner's Montana Grill chain or P.F. Chang's or Black Angus Steakhouse, big nationwide companies like that. In addition, a lot of money through that program was paid out in fees to the major banks like J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, et cetera, to process the loans through the Paycheck Protection Program. So a very large amount of that taxpayer money was given to very, very large corporations who we could argue are not doing that badly under COVID-19. Now, the second biggest item in this stimulus bill is $180 billion for unemployed Americans. That would be in the form of additional payments of $300 per month or per week. No, per month. Sorry, per week, per person on top of their state unemployment benefits, if they can qualify for unemployment and have been able to actually get it through their states. A lot of states have been dealing with unemployment fraud, like here in Washington state, massive amounts of unemployment fraud where people who have legitimate claims for unemployment have not been able to get their claims processed because there's been a halt on a lot of unemployment claims while the state tries to figure out which ones are legitimate and which ones are not. Now, federal payments under the first round of additional unemployment payments expired in July, and then Trump unilaterally extended them to the end of October, of course, so that he could win people's votes for the November election. And then he didn't extend them through the end of the year. He just let them lapse at the end of October. And now an estimated 20.2 million unemployed Americans are really beginning to feel the pinch. Now, the third biggest item in the bill is $160 billion for state and local governments, which, of course, is just a drop in the bucket of what's really needed to keep these smaller governments from shutting down necessary services and laying off workers. This is the one piece of the legislation that the Republicans are balking at, although a significant contingent also are against the unemployment benefits, too, and that includes Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He's been pushing for zero in additional unemployment benefits, but I think he's willing to accept at least a small amount, that $180 billion that I talked about before. Now, the one provision that Democrats are against and that they're just allowing to slide by in this bill is a liability shield. That's a provision that would shield all businesses from being sued by their employees for not protecting them from COVID-19. The Republicans have insisted that this be included to provide protection for major corporations who are currently experiencing record numbers of sick employees. For example, you could think about the over 19,000 Amazon warehouse workers who've contracted COVID-19, and that was the tally just through September 30th. I'm sure it's much higher now and will be much higher once the Christmas shopping season is completed. Those businesses, if this bill passes, would get liability protection from any lawsuit that their employees could file based on whether or not they provided adequate protection against their employees contracting COVID-19. Now, there are other smaller items in this bill, including $82 billion for schools, $45 billion for transportation agencies, $26 billion for food programs, $25 billion to address rental evictions, $16 billion for vaccine distribution, and $10 billion for the U.S. Postal Service, which is still experiencing delays in shipping packages and processing regular mail. Now, some really big important items are not in the bill. In spite of providing $25 billion for rental assistance, there is no renewal of the federal moratorium on evictions. That's a big one. Without that renewal on a moratorium on evictions, up to 30 million renters are at risk of becoming homeless in 2021 without that provision included. So that's the big one that's missing out of the bill. In addition, there are no new stimulus checks for those of us who've managed to keep our jobs, but maybe are struggling to work the usual number of hours we typically work, or to make ends meet and meet our bill payments. There's no hazard pay for essential workers who've had to spend extra money for protective gear and for medical treatment when they do get COVID-19, especially if their employers are not doing anything to really protect them from getting the virus. And there's no new tax cuts that Republicans and Donald Trump have been trying to push to add to any stimulus bill like this. Things like payroll tax cuts or payroll tax deferrals or more tax cuts for large corporations. So that's what's in the bill and what's not in the bill. And I would say it's a deeply imperfect bill, but the Democrats are pushing to get something passed to provide some kind of help to unemployed Americans who lost their additional benefits at the end of October, and some additional help for state and local governments who have been laying off people in recent months, and that's been contributing to to the economic crisis in a lot of small communities around the nation.
All right. Doesn't sound real promising.
No, it doesn't. Let's talk a little bit about Biden's cabinet appointees this week.
Okay.
How much time do we have left, Mike?
You've got about 13 minutes.
Okay. So this week, Joe Biden appointed a large number of members of his economic team, starting off with Neera Tanden, who will be the director of the Office of Management and Budget. Tanden was she's president and CEO of the Center for American Progress, a centrist Democratic think tank. She served in both Clinton and Obama administrations. She helped to shape the Affordable Care Act, and she worked on Hillary Clinton's campaign. Republicans hate her because she's got a very active Twitter account, and she tweets fairly frequently about she tweets some not very nice things about Republican economic policies. And I think it's a stretch to call a lot of Republican economic proposals actual policies when I think they're more economic fantasies. But she's also used her Twitter platform to heavily criticize progressive policies put forth by the left wing of the Democratic Party, particularly by Bernie Sanders and his supporters, but also other progressive folks like Elizabeth Warren. Now, as for the federal budget, which she would be drafting, she seems fine with running federal deficits to provide stimulus to the economy. She's also supportive of government assistance for things like child care, health care, and she at least recognizes income inequality as a problem, although we don't know yet what kind of budgetary policies she would support to address that. So she's going to be primarily involved with drafting Biden's budget plan when he provides a budget to Congress. And that means it's super important that we know what her stance is on tax policy in terms of raising taxes on wealthy Americans and corporations and providing tax credits to low-income folks. And it's super important that we know what her spending priorities would be, too, and how much of a federal deficit she would be willing to support. Right now, we don't know the details of any of those things, so she's kind of an open question. Now, the second person that he announced this week was Cecilia Rouse. She is being proposed as chair of the Council of Economic Advisers. The Council of Economic Advisers advises the president on general economic policy, and it's usually a three-person team. Cecilia Rouse is being proposed as the chair of that team. She's currently the dean of the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. She sat on Bill Clinton's National Economic Council from 1998 to 1999 and on Obama's Council of Economic Advisers from 2009 to 2011. She's a labor economist with an emphasis on the economics of education. She's also a director of T. Rowe Price Equity Mutual Funds and an advisory board member of T. Rowe Price Fixed Income Mutual Funds. That's a connection that's made some folks say that she's too close to Wall Street. She's most known for a study she published in 2000 on bias against women during the auditioning process for hiring orchestral musicians. But her more recent research work has been on college education and workers' employment prospects, analyzing two-year community colleges versus four-year schools, and how school voucher programs affect low-performing schools. So she's more coming from the how does education and higher education help middle-class Americans and Americans who are struggling to make it into the middle class. Now, the other two members of the Council of Economic Advisors, he announced this week, are Jared Bernstein and Heather Bauchi. Bernstein was Biden's chief economist and economic advisor when he was vice president in the Obama administration. Bernstein's a labor economist who's most recently served as a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He's considered progressive, with his main concerns being income inequality, wage stagnation, and how federal government programs can help low-income people. Because of his long association with Biden, he would seem to be the natural person to head the Council of Economic Advisors. But I think Biden chose Rouse because he thought Bernstein would be a heavy lift to try to get him approved and working with Republicans in Congress, because he's just way too progressive for anyone currently in the Republican Party. Now, Heather Bauchi is the third person who would sit on Biden's Council of Economic Advisors. She's another alumnus of the Center for American Progress. She's the president and CEO of the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. She was a favorite of Hillary Clinton's and would have helped to manage her transition team had Clinton won in 2016. So Bauchi's clearly more of a centrist or conservative Democrat. Bauchi's been serving as an economic advisor on Biden's campaign team. Her research has focused mostly on the impact of welfare reform on working families, welfare reform that was passed in the Bill Clinton administration. With Biden's support. She's also interested in income inequality and its impact on economic growth. So she looks at it not necessarily its impact on working families, but more on its impact on the overall economy in general. And she has looked at the impact of economic downturns on women's participation in the labor force in particular, noting that when there's an economic downturn and lots of layoffs, women are the ones who usually stay home to take care of the kids, and that impacts their long-term career prospects. She was born, and as a side note, she was born in Seattle and raised in Mukilteo, so she's local here from Washington State. Yeah, that's Heather Bauchi. Now, his final member of his economic team that Biden announced this week was Brian Deese, he will be the top White House economic advisor directly to the president. Brian Deese is closer to Wall Street than any of these other appointments. His title is at the big BlackRock investment firm currently is Global Head of Sustainable Investing. He, in the past has served as a senior advisor to President Obama, as deputy director of the Office of Management and Budget, and as deputy director of the National Economic Council. He has also worked as a senior policy analyst for economic policy at the Center for American Progress, so yet another CAP alumni. He was also an economic policy director for Hillary Clinton's campaign. So, you know, deep roots within the Democratic Party, kind of mainstream of the Democratic Party. In the Obama administration, Deese played a key role in negotiating the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. But I should point out, in his role as head of sustainable investing at BlackRock Investments, Deese has not opposed BlackRock's heavy investment in fossil fuel companies, and he's highly unlikely to support a move away from subsidizing oil and gas companies by the federal government. Also, Biden has come out against limiting fracking, and I very much doubt that Brian Deese would advise him to limit fracking or limit natural gas consumption within the United States. So even though he played a key role in negotiating the Paris Climate Agreement, he could be viewed as somebody who was willing to put on the brakes and not necessarily go for higher limits to greenhouse gas emissions. So that is Biden's first rank of economic advisors there, in addition to having appointed Janet Yellen as his Treasury Secretary last week. So
yep.
That's my look at it.
Well, lots more appointments in the weeks to come.
Oh, yes, much more.
We're still waiting for Attorney General, for example. That's going to be a big one.
Yeah, the two big ones that are left are Attorney General and Department of Defense. And there's been some pressure on Biden to appoint somebody who's not white since he appointed Janet Yellen as his Treasury Secretary. And he's appointed other white people in his other very powerful White House cabinet positions. So we will see what Biden comes up with in the coming weeks for those two big powerhouse positions, but also the other important cabinet members like Health and Human Services and I also want to say Education Secretary, who's going to replace and try to reverse the damage that Betsy DeVos has done.
EPA, Interior, there's a lot of damage to be reversed. It's a lot easier to destroy things than it is to build them up, as we've found out.
Yeah.
All right. Finally, just a few minutes update on the challenges to this last election.
Yeah, the clown car coup is still underway. The Trump legal team filed a bunch more lawsuits on Friday. Right now, I believe they're 1 win and 42 losses in their court challenges so far. And really, the whole purpose of this doesn't seem to be to actually try and overturn the election. The deadline for states to certify their electors is next Tuesday. And then I believe it's the 14th the Electoral College actually meets and Biden's win will become official. But Trump has raised over $200 million, mostly from small donors, since the election in a fund that's supposedly going to his legal expenses. But if you read the fine print, you see that well, some of it goes to the Republican National Committee, and the rest of it is essentially a slush fund that Trump can do whatever he wants with. He can pay his personal expenses with it. He can salary himself. It's pure profit for Trump. So this is all an elaborate scam, and it seems like a fitting coda for his 4 years in office. It's jaw-dropping how many people are willing to just send him their money for him to do whatever he wants with. That's what's been going on, and that's really what his attempt to stay in office has come down to. The other thing that we're seeing is a continuing wholesale replacement of the top leadership of national security agencies, whether it's the Pentagon or intelligence agencies, the National Security Council, and so forth, with Trump loyalists who are grossly underqualified for their positions. The one thing that those loyalists have been doing is refusing to cooperate with the incoming administration. So that, for example, the various intelligence agencies, I think there's a couple dozen of them, that fall under the Pentagon are not giving intelligence briefings to the incoming Trump team, incoming Biden team, I'm sorry. And you have to ask why. You know, it doesn't seem like it's mere petulance. It seems like there's something else going on, but nobody is.
My feeling is that they're probably that Trump probably replaced a lot of those people so that the new, you know, in the last month or so, these new cronies of his can go through these offices and just destroy documents. That's my theory.
I think there's that. And I think, you know, Trump has some international buddies who would love to not have eyes on them for a couple months. You know, whether they're in Russia or Saudi Arabia or wherever Trump has financial interests, Turkey, there's just so many ways in which the motives of this administration can be legitimately questioned as to whether they're working for or against American interests. And mind you, you know, U.S. foreign policy has not historically been a thing to be proud of, but you know, there are bad actors out there that are working against, you know, security of the American economy, for example. There's a lot of money at stake. There's a lot of jobs at stake. It's a legitimate question whether the president of the United States is working for a foreign power at this point, I think. Yeah, right, that's your remote.
That's a good place to end it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we are, I was going to say unfortunately out of time, but I think I'm going to say we're fortunately out of time today.
Well, and, we'll be back, and hopefully the technology will work better next week.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right. We will talk to you both then.